So welcome everybody. I'm Jean Demler. I'm the chair of the mental health section. So I wanted to do a couple little announcements before we start, since we have a couple minutes. As many of you know, we have a booth in the exhibit hall, the mental health section booth. How many people might have gotten there at this point? Oh, good. Okay. There's literature there. There's some mental health literature. There's also literature about our section and different activities that are going on during the program. So I'm going to ask you all, if you get a chance, to stop by the booth. It's number 5090. It's right with all of the other APHA places. One additional item there is that we don't have it staffed all the time, and the person who's setting it up has to go do some other things. So if you would have an inclination to stand there, you just talk to people, give out some of the information, answer questions. If you can't answer them, say you'll find the answer. But it would be great if other people would be willing to step up to that job. You meet a lot of people. It really is useful in terms of networking. I just happen to have brought along the sign-up sheet for the staff. So I thought I could pass it around, and if you see a slot that's empty and you think that you could help at that time, it would be great. You don't have to be an expert in the section, you know. You just have to say, we're a section, there's a little brochure, you can look at quickly if you want more information. But we try to be a welcoming section, and I just don't like it sort of sitting there with nobody staffing it. It looks kind of forlorn. And I think, well, people must think, what are those mental health people doing? So if you have a chance and you're willing, I'm going to pass this around, and feel free to put your name down. If you want to ask me questions later, or ask, well, you can ask Christine, because Christine's been doing a lot of it. So if you want to ask her some questions before you sign up, that's fine too.
Let them know when the social is tomorrow at 7, and invite people to join our section. And there's a packet of information there for people who might be interested in mental health. And there's literature on schizophrenia, bipolar, a bunch of pamphlets there, as well as some candy. And yeah, just to make people feel welcome and to hopefully participate in the mental health section. As a primary section or as an adjunct to the other section.
Thanks, Christine. Yes, the other piece that I would want to talk about is what Christine said is the mental health section social reception, which is tomorrow night, 7 to 9, in this hotel in the Farragut Room. And we have some awards, and we just have a chance to talk to each other. It's not dinner. Couldn't afford dinner. But there's a few appetizers and a cash bar. So please come. So then welcome to this session of integrating mental health and other services. Clearly this is a huge topic, at least in Colorado it is. We have quite a few projects that are trying to either integrate substance abuse and mental health, or substance abuse and primary care, or mental health and substance abuse, all different kinds of integrating. So I'm really pleased that we have some of this on our schedule for this year, and hopefully for next year as well. We're going to have the papers in order, 20 minutes each, and then we'll have questions. I think this will be the best way to facilitate. And then obviously if we're still going, you can talk with some of the presenters afterwards. Our first presenter today is Dr. Cynthia Summers, and she's the Executive Director of Take Care New York. She has her doctorate in public health from the University of Illinois at Chicago. She has worked with the New York City Health Department for, I think, since 2007, I saw. And she's going to be talking about integration of mental health and correction services.
Good afternoon, everybody. But before I forget, I'll do my disclosure. I have no relationships to disclose. So I'm going to be talking to you today about a pilot program, a pilot mental health program that we have rolled out in the New York City jail system. What I'm going to present to you today is a description of that program and kind of the New York City jail system, and then some very preliminary results that we've just manually analyzed for this presentation here today. And hopefully it'll be another few months before we have full results. So for those who aren't familiar, New York City has 11 jail facilities. Each of them have at least one health clinic. 9 of those jail facilities are on Rikers Island, which I'll show you a picture of shortly. But on any given day, there's about 13,000 people in the New York City jail system. The interesting thing that distinguishes local jails to the state prison system usually is when you see that third bullet. More than 80% of our population are pre-sentencing detainees awaiting trial. So this impacts our ability to do all different kinds of care because their stay with us is very short. And just to give a sense of volume from another perspective, we had 90,000 new admissions in 2010. And you can see that the average length of stay for sentenced inmates is 37 days. For detainees, it's 46 days. It's much longer for the mentally ill population. You can see it's almost 3 times as long at 110 days. But the interesting thing are those final 2 bullets where 28% leave in 2 to 3 days and 52% leave within a week. So here's an kind of overview shot of Rikers Island, and you can see how spread out. Those are 9 different jail facilities on Rikers Island, and that's the majority of that's where the majority of detainees and inmates are housed. The other thing with New York City's jail system that is interesting is most places, when you look at the providers, mental health providers, medical care providers in a jail facility, if you go up to their boss and their boss and their boss and their boss, eventually you're going to be at someone who's in a uniform because that's usually run by and overseen by Department of Corrections. New York City Charter distinguished that and basically said health should be overseen by the health department. And so we jointly operate the care of inmates in the New York City jail system, with Department of Health and Mental Hygiene being responsible for all healthcare, mental health, dental, urgent, hospital, inpatient oversight, and that never ever reports to Department of Corrections. And then Corrections does custody, security, all the logistical and operation side of things. And so we work together in parallel. In theory, in a cooperative manner. Sometimes it's a little less than cooperative, but we do work together. So this, I just wanted to give a sense of the health in general. This is self-reported for both New York City general population and for incoming inmates. You can see that some of the kind of indicators of overall health that we tend to use, smoking, you can see New York City is at less than 16% as a whole, and people coming into the jail system are nearly 3/4. Asthma, also 4 times as high in the jail system, and mental health problems, you can see 20% versus 6%. It's actually higher than that. Again, these are self-reported data. So if you look at mental health status in New York City jails, 1/3 have a mental health diagnosis, and 20% of that 1/3 are seriously mentally ill. 50% also have a substance abuse diagnosis, and then 36% overall have an actual substance abuse diagnosis, but that is arguably much higher. Those are people who are actually diagnosed. So we have a very high diagnosis rate among people who are mentally ill because they're screened for it. But if someone else is in the general population without another serious mental illness, it's not known how often that's actually picked up. So fast forward to last year, and we decided in our jail facility that has the largest proportion of our seriously mentally ill inmates, and those are people who have to be in a specialized mental observation unit because they are too ill to be housed in the general population, that we would adapt and implement an evidence-based curriculum that is just a radical change from general care. It is multiple group-based therapy sessions 6 days a week. So all of the, you can see through cognitive-based therapy, motivational enhancement, it's an incentive-based program. These inmates who participate in this program, which is voluntary, spend about 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, give or take, in a group treatment setting. So this kind of lays out what our standard treatment was before the program. You can see that it's mostly individual therapy and discharge planning. It was clinic-based, meaning that inmates were taken from their housing unit to a central clinic for any services that they received. It was much more, I wouldn't say bare bones. I think we still in New York City have a standard of care that is much higher than in a lot of correctional facilities, but it was not an intensive ongoing therapy process. And if you look at the after, once we implemented this program, you can see that they have every day, well, 6 days a week, intensive and structured group therapy, two mental health sessions a day, one community session in the morning. They have at least one discharge planning session where they focus on skills to integrate into the community. They do Medicaid applications. They do other social service applications. And then they also have one either art therapy session or they're starting a music therapy session. They have recreational therapy. And one of the big changes was that staff are now located on the units. So it's a very person-centered approach. So the clinical staff are there with the patients all day. So there's a presence. They have an office there. There's no more going to this clinic and to this clinic. There are incentives for participation in and kind of adherence to rules or good behavior in the program. Those start out with things as basic as a package of new t-shirts, socks, and underwear when they're starting, to vouchers for a haircut, commissary dollars, movies. There's a coordinated treatment team among all the different kinds of providers. Case management with medical as well. And like I said before, an increased focus on reentry skills building. So we rolled this out in November 2010 in two dorm units, which are literally kind of what they sound like. They're less secure in terms of, there's no solitary confinement in cells. There's 47 beds that are laid out in each of these like dorms. And then also in one of our cell units, which has 20 beds, and those are individual locked cells for higher security inmates. As might be expected, there were and continue to be some operational challenges. Some of those come from the relationship that I talked about earlier, where we work in parallel with Department of Correction, but with different missions and different staffing models. And so when there are, for example, a shortage of beds that are needed for a certain type, it's not under our control, meaning the health department's control, to dictate the movement of inmates between these units. So it has happened and it continues to happen where we have participants in the program and suddenly clinicians come in the morning and three of them are gone and they're in a different housing unit. And there's not an explanation about why that happened, and it disrupts care. We've also had some challenges with some of the incentives. I think there's some evidence that it's not only the incentives, of course, that drive the success of this program, but it is part of what inmates are looking forward to and working towards, and there have been some problems with not having those delivered when they're supposed to be delivered, and having delays and other operational challenges, and so that has been hard. Although I would say it's definitely now that we're a year into it, it's definitely better than it was when we started. I think just overall, separate from formal evaluation, I think from Department of Corrections side and Department of Health side, there's been a lot of enthusiasm and energy for the program. There's been a lot of praise and satisfaction also among the inmates. I've had three, when I've gone in just to do observation, I've had three separate inmates when I've asked them about the program, same words, not talking to each other, have said, "I love it. It's the first time anyone's actually cared about me." And, you know, I think 6 hours of programming, six days a week will do that, even though it's hard. It shows a commitment to the patients while they're there. So, for our evaluation plan, what we're going to be doing for the big evaluation is taking all of the programmed units for a 6-month period from January to June of this year and comparing that to the same time frame, same housing units from last year, pre-programming. I'll talk a little bit later about some of the limitations and struggles we had with arriving at that design, and I'm still not sure if it's perfect, but I think it's the best alternative, or the best choice. So our research questions are, does participation in the program reduce incidence of violence during the incarceration? Does it improve symptoms of mental illness? And does it increase length of community survival post-release, so the time before ending up back in jail? Some of the outcome measures that we are looking at and or hoping to look at are days on suicide watch, patient self-injury, hospital runs, use of force by DOC is a big one, as well as infractions on units, incidents of violence, recidivism, but that'll take a little while to get at because we're defining that as rearrest and incarceration within 1 year of release. So there will be a delay to getting that. And then connection to care on the outside. That one is tricky because it relies on access to the state Medicaid claims data, which we're close, but it's still a little bit limited. And then some of the key outcome measures that are most important to us, you know, incidents of violence, use of force, those are tough for a couple reasons. Those are data sets that are not ours. They're Department of Correction generated and owned. It's been a little bit of a struggle, say the least, to get those data. And then it's also a question that I'll talk about in a minute about, we also have no control over the validity of that data because we don't report on it. So we're gonna look at the data in two different ways. One is what, for lack of a more sophisticated term, I'll just call a dose response. So looking at all of the people in the mental observation units last year, obviously all of them will have zero dose. All of the people in the mental observation units this year, for some of those who weren't on programmed units, it'll be zero. And then for the ones who participated in the program, it will be however many days they were participating. We're doing that to try and minimize the selection bias because this is a voluntary program, and then also to try and get rid of some of the biases and just lack of control and chaos that from movement in and out of these units that are unrelated to how someone's doing in the program thing. We'll also look at it just in a more standard retrospective comparison where we're looking at the people who participated this year versus the people last year. So data access, selection bias, reliability of reporting, especially from Department of Corrections side, and the lack of control over program entry and exit. That said, for this presentation, I had my great staff pull 100 people from each group, so program participants this year, program non-participants this year, and then from the comparison group last year. So looking just at the participants and non-participants, you can see that there's really no difference in race between the people who chose to participate and those who didn't. You can see that overall, age, it's an older population a little bit who chooses to participate, which is probably not surprising. It's a big time commitment. There's not much free time or idle time. And a lot of the ones you see who come in the 18 to 25 range opt not to do it. Top charge, we just wanted to see if there was a difference in, you know, whether certain kinds of criminals were choosing to participate in the program. Given the numbers that we looked at, I don't think there's much difference. Same thing, we were trying to look at whether, you know, there's a difference in the Access 1 and Access 2 groups who were choosing, and it looks like not proportionality is about the same. So as I mentioned, we looked at 100 from each group. All three were random samples generated. And the incident reporting system that we got from Department of Correction, we actually went and manually looked up in their system. That mostly has inmate and inmate fighting, assault on an officer, refusing to obey orders. Then also arrest. There can be a new arrest while someone's in jail. So if you're already incarcerated and you commit a crime while you're in jail, you can have another arrest. And then also serious injury to another inmate. So interestingly, or not, what we found is that, validity of data aside, there's really no difference between the participants and non-participants this year. One could argue that that might not be so surprising because there's a very cohesive nature. I've sat in these dorms and in these areas, and when you come in now, there are people who have gone through and are at level 4, and they're the leaders of the group, and they welcome them. When new people come in, they tell them how this group operates and how this dorm operates. It's a very, very cohesive structure. And even for those who don't participate in the program, they're exposed to it daily, just as many hours a day. You could also argue that there might be an incentive for less reporting this year if there's desire that the program look good. So I'm short on time, but I think we don't know yet, But one other thing that is interesting is we looked at program participants this year and non-participants from who are this year also. So this is the same time period. And you look at the self-injurious behavior, and we had 4 in the 6-month period who were program participants, compared with 19 who were non-participants. Again, small numbers, but promising. So I think what we've learned so far is that there are real challenges in doing a rigorous evaluation in a jail setting, but it's also so important to do it so that we learn how to help this group that is kind of the definition of a vulnerable population, and how to treat them best and make things better. And that's all.